terminal.
All right, the achiever pressure looks good.
Tomlin up. Roger, the planet.
Water towers fly!
Yes! Tango down to nominal.
Water towers fly, SCE off.
Bring in, SCE dog. Off.
Yikes.
You bet.
Concur.
We don't need any more of these.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of NSF Live, where we cover space news from this past week, space news coming up this week, and everything in between. Seeing some 5x5s in chats, that's great to hear that you all can see and hear us properly. And speaking of us, who is us? Well, starting off over here, let's see. Oh, yeah, that's Thomas. Again, this is a running gag.
I'm glad you do the exact same thing I do. Thank you.
I don't know who's on my left or right until I put my hand up and say, oh, there we go. So that's Thomas Burghardt, news director with NASA Spaceflight, one of the co-hosts today. How's it going, Thomas?
Oh, going well. Good to be on the show as always. Thanks, Ian.
Always great. And of course, over here, we have Adrian, Mr. Spreadsheet Man, who's working on some spreadsheets, I've heard, which is going to be very exciting. How's it going over here, Adrian?
It's going great. And I want to use my introductory segment to point out that the managing editor of this platform was surprised we were on time. Just to point that out.
I saw some people in chat saying, oh, they went live on time. And we did it. But yeah,
I think Doss said it best that NSF is never early nor late. They go live precisely when they intend to. So I'm just gonna stick with that as our motto here.
A spaceflight news company is never early nor is it late. All right, but we got a nice group of topics to discuss this week, starting off with the first Electron launch from Wallops and the first Electron launch not from New Zealand. This is pretty big, and it's been a long time coming. So this was the launch of three Hawkeye 360 radio satellites from Wallops. So Thomas, what happened here on this launch that we're looking at right here?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the big milestone for this launch is that it was the first from the United States. This is the third overall launch pad that Rocket Lab has brought online, second launch site, because they do have two pads down at Launch Complex, one in New Zealand. And they've been working towards getting this pad online for a while as a good launch site for U.S. government customers who want to maintain those operations within the United States for national security reasons or stuff like that. And then also just upping their launch cadence a little bit more, having a little bit more flexibility for their customers, which has been a pretty common theme across multiple small sat launchers. There's definitely a couple other companies that have also attempted to launch their small sat launch vehicle from multiple different launch complexes. And Rocket Lab on this flight became the first one to successfully reach orbit from two different launch sites. So congrats to the teams on that. Not an easy feat to take success in one launch complex and replicate all of that success and all of that reliability at a different location. But as you mentioned, of course, the main focus should always be the actual mission that was launched, and that was three satellites for Hawkeye 360. They're small satellites used for radio intelligence, used for a bunch of different civilian and military customers. Rocket Lab says that their next launch of the year, this was the first one of the year for Rocket Lab as well, and they say the next one should also be from Wallops. I don't think they specified what exactly that mission will be, but this was the first of three Hawkeye 360 missions, so it might just be another Hawkeye batch. We'll have to wait and see, but this is going to be the addition of kind of an auxiliary launch site for Rocket Lab. Primary ops seem to still be focused on Mahia. Sorry, Sawyer, he's going to roast me for getting that wrong, in New Zealand with the Launch Complex 1A and 1B, but they'll have a little bit more flexibility and be able to offer the US-based launch site as needed. And overall, they should help them increase their launch cadence a little bit and just basically remove any bottlenecks as far as launch site availability and make sure that their launch rate is purely based on customer demand. As soon as customers are ready, they can be ready to launch. We also got some questions about recoverability because Rocket Lab's experimenting with Electron recovery. That'll help make them inform the Neutron program down the line. And it sounds like that system is going to stay in New Zealand for now. They'll work on experimental recoveries of Electron, the first stage there. And then maybe down the line, once that system is proven, they will consider scaling that up to Wallops as well, even though Wallops is expected to have less launch cadence than New Zealand does. But Rocket Lab will definitely be focusing on Wallops in the future because that is the Neutron launch site for their medium lift reusable launch vehicles. So we'll be keeping an eye on that as well. They already have like a big kind of those semi-temporary, semi-permanent tents used for some early production and pathfinding and things like that out just down the road from the launch site that Electron uses. And we'll be keeping an eye on that as well. But it was great for NSF to be able to be in person and covering the launch. We had our good buddy Pat out there operating a camera and be able to have our own dedicated broadcast of a Rocket Lab launch, which we don't really get to do because none of us live in New Zealand, unfortunately. But looking forward to do that again for future launches as well.
Yeah, and like you said, we had some great tracking out there from Pat. I remember we had it like almost to second stage entry.
Yeah.
That was a tremendous track from Pat. Thanks in part, of course, to the fact that it was a bit of a twilight effect, not as extreme as a twilight of a twilight effect as say on Falcon 9, but because the sun was the sun had set a little bit earlier than normal, but still some great shots of the second stage there, a beautiful inaugural launch. From Wallops from Rocket Lab, and hopefully one of many more. Like you said, they want to bring Neutron down there. That's going to be the Neutron facility. I mean, in my mind, a really big comparison is kind of that's going to be Rocket Lab's Boca Chica, because honestly, because it's not really used that often. They're moving in force. That's going to be their primary launch site for Neutron manufacturing facility. It's going to be growing a lot over the next few years, and I'm very excited to see what happens with that.
Yeah, and to add, I'm sure we're going to get some questions to discuss about Rocket Lab and Wallops and things like that. But you mentioned the visibility. It was a super clear night, which lended Pat the great visibility of tracking that rocket for so long. But hopefully, this will also just increase Wallops' launch cadence overall. Wallops traditionally has only hosted two, maybe three Antares launches a year. Those are the only orbital launches Wallops got with any regularity. Every once in a while, you also get a Minotaur or something like that. But hopefully with more launches, you know, Rocket Lab launches every month or so, that could drastically increase the orbital launch cadence from Wallops. And for all those people that live on the East Coast of the US, should hopefully get some really good visibility of a couple more rocket launches, since people will be able to catch a glimpse even from their own backyards or something like that. So that could be cool too.
Can you guys stop snacking up every single rocket launch in the world? Like at some point, you just need to leave some launches for the rest of us, right?
There are launches from Europe coming down the line. You know, we've covered that in previous shows. They're coming.
Well, there was one from Europe. Well, it's debatable how much from Europe the Virgin Orbit launch was, but there's going to be some homegrown European rockets coming soon, and that's going to be very exciting to watch that prosper as well. And Lauren here is saying in chat, Pat was a rock star at Wallops. Absolutely. Tremendous track all around from Pat. Again, big thanks to Pat for showing up and helping out with NSF there. Let's see, any questions? So Brett here is asking, does anyone know if Arbuckle Neck and or the old ferry docks will be open for these launches in the future? Well, Brett, unfortunately, we don't really know exactly what is going to be open and what's going to be closed or blocked off from Wallops launches until they're actually posted. But based on how this launch closure was set up and based on what was open, Arbuckle Neck Road was open. And for those who are unaware, Arbuckle Neck and Old Ferry Docks are two Wallops viewing sites, two very popular sites. Arbuckle Neck is about 1.9 miles away, which is extremely close for a rocket viewing site. That was open on this launch, and I think it's pretty safe to assume that for Electron launches, Arbuckle Neck will be open. And I have never seen the old ferry docks be closed for a launch before, so yeah. I think both of those are safe options for the future for Rocket Lab down there.
And highly recommend. Wallops is one of those places where you get a lot closer than most other launch sites because it's a relatively small range. There's only a couple pads, unlike Cape Canaveral, where you have a huge base. Which just means you're by default going to be a little farther away from any launch pads. Plenty of good launch sites, launch viewing sites, but Wallops gets you about as close as you can get. Highly recommend. Yep.
Yeah, Wallops, it's great. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's a beautiful site. highly recommend anyone go down there. You're laughing as if middle of nowhere is a bad thing. I'm a country boy at heart. But thanks for the question, Brett. And of course, speaking of questions, this is a very interactive show. So if there's any questions you have about any topics we're discussing, any topics we might discuss, anything about SpaceX, Starship, be sure to hit us up in chat with @NASA Spaceflight. It'll make your questions pop up here in a fancy queue I've got up here on my monitor, and it makes it so much easier for us to see your questions, pick them, and answer them on stream. So, moving on from that, we had a few comments coming up here in the chat saying, are we going to have the merch pie again this weekend? And merch pie target on Adrian. Now, if anyone here is unaware of what merch pie means, we have a fun little saying that when anyone buys something from the NASA Spaceflight store, shop.nasaspaceflight.com, there's a nice little notification that comes up on stream and whacks Adrian right in the face. Of course, not physically. We don't want to harm. No NSF broadcasters were harmed in the making of this production, but it just covers up his face. It's a nice little thing. And if you buy anything from the store, your name will pop up, what you bought pops up, and as well as any messages. And speaking of, we actually do have a message in here from a store purchase saying, let me be the first to cast a pie at Adrian. So thank you very much there.
I just want to point out that there were some negotiations before the show who's getting top slot here, and I apparently lost. That's all I want to say about this.
Yep. Yeah. It's a bit of a a fun little gag who gets to sit in the pie seat. But yeah, so if you purchase something from the store at shop.nasaspaceflight.com, which we have so many collections, we have some new Falcon Heavy collections we've just come out with. We have so much Starship merch. We're actually going to be discussing Starship a bit later in the show. Anything you can really think of, we have in the shop. We have t-shirts, hoodies, mugs, towels, whatever you can think of. Basically, we have some amazing metal prints too of some rocket launches captured over the past 2 years. Once again, that's shop.nasaspaceflight.com. If you purchase something and toss a message into your purchase, it'll show up here on the stream and punch Adrian in the face, metaphorically, of course. But again, that's a great way to support the work that we do, and we really appreciate all of the help that comes through from there. And moving on to our next topic, we're moving a bit south from Wallops here down to Cape Canaveral. Word has come out that ground has been broken on a crew tower for, at first, cargo missions, but then Crew Dragon missions from Slick 40. Now that's SpaceX's inaugural Falcon 9 launch pad, which up until now they've been using only for commercial and some governmental missions, never any crew launches, and they seem to pause doing cargo launches from there as well. But since Starship is coming up at 39A, it seems that they're starting to reconsider having only one pad for crew and cargo missions. So Thomas and Adrian, do one of you want to take us through what exactly is happening at Slick 40 and the why of it?
Yeah, NASA, I think, pretty much confirmed what we already speculated in our flyover. There was groundbreaking on Slick 40 for the crew access tower for Falcon 9. What we saw, so how this came as started as a rumor and then became a fact that is now confirmed, is we saw some excavators there, we saw some groundbreaking, some fence were removed, concrete was removed, and yeah, and suddenly NASA confirmed this is indeed the crew tower that will in the future allow for crewed Falcon 9 launches from Slick 40. They also confirmed that it will support Cargo Dragon first as early as this fall, and then maybe move later, or not maybe, but move later then to crew flights from there. So this gives them a bit more redundancy on like crew access to the International Space Station. So I would say that is pretty warranted with the fact that the largest rocket of all time will soon launch right next to the only tower that right now gives crew access to the ISS from America.
Yeah, it's great to have some a bit of a redundancy there, especially like you said, because now they're launching Starship from there. But even Starship aside, it's great to have a bit of redundancy in the off chance, and of course we never want it to happen, but in case something happened at the pad with Falcon 9, or if there was, say, like a natural disaster or something, just it's great to have redundancy there. Same with Shuttle in 39A and 39B. So it's going to be a great addition here to our arsenal. What were you going to say, Adrian?
Also, from an ops perspective, if you look at how SpaceX plans and sometimes has to move stuff around at launches, I would imagine it helps to have one vehicle that is no longer like a long launch that is no longer fixed on one single launch pad. We still have the situation that Falcon Heavy can only launch from 39A, but that also gives them wiggle room in how they plan the missions, when a pad becomes available, which I would imagine with trying to go for 100 launches a year might be a bit of an issue where you're like, okay, we cannot really have to sit idle for 2 weeks because you need to launch in these 2 weeks. So yeah, definitely a capability that also SpaceX will enjoy in the future, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have a whole bunch of questions in coming in here into the queue. First off, you're from Trevor asking, will the tower be similar to the one at 39A? Thomas or Adrian, do we have any info on what this tower is going to look like, what the design is going to be like? Do we know anything like that?
So I would hazard a guess that it's going to look pretty different from 39A, at least, you know, size and shape wise. I would imagine that the SpaceX aesthetic rules will still apply and it will still look something out of, you know, the 2030s or something. But as far as the axles, I would imagine it's going to be smaller. Remember, the tower at 39A is actually the same tower that was used for crew access for the space shuttle. And hosted, you know, on the side was for the rotating service structure and things like that. So that tower was repurposed from shuttle use, and for the purposes of now, it's only used as an elevator to get up to the crew access level for Crew Dragon. So I would imagine a tower purpose-built at 40 for the purposes of accessing a dragon on top of Falcon 9 can be, you know, not quite as big. It'll be a little thinner, get up just as high as they need it to. Also remember, Pad 40 already has 4 lightning towers, and so there might not need to be a giant lightning mast on top of the crew access tower. Think maybe similar to Pad 41 and the crew access tower that ULA built to support Starliner missions. I would imagine it's going to probably be something more similar to that. But we'll have to wait and see exactly what it looks like, because we haven't seen any official documentation other than we've seen documentation saying there will be a tower, but none have documented how exactly the tower is going to look or anything like that.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about it too, they're really starting from a blank sheet, so they can make the tower whatever they need it to be and nothing more. Like you said, the tower at 39A, well, it was originally built for the Apollo missions. So it had to have the elevator, it had to have service platforms, the umbilical arms, and for shuttle, it had to have the umbilical arms support the rotating service structure. Many, many tasks for that tower. Whereas now it's just get crew up to the vehicle, maybe put some fancy cameras on the platforms in between. But the one at 40, I would be surprised if it's anything but simple, anything but just a slim, simple tower with a crew access arm on the end of it. And that's it, because Falcon 9 doesn't need umbilical arms. It doesn't need any quick disconnects on a tower. It's everything's built into the strong back and the launch pad. So the tower is solely there for crew access, like you said, much like the one at Slick 41. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see a somewhat similar concept to that at 41. And kind of riding off of that as well, Nicholas here asking, will Slick 40 have a dragon-capable strong back like the one at 39A? I think it's... Go ahead, Thomas.
Yeah, so kind of already does. If you'll remember, before it was Dragon 2, the original cargo dragon, which was all of its payloads were loaded in the horizontal configuration, there wasn't a late load for that vehicle. Well, I mean, there was, but not in the sense that they used an access arm while the rocket was already vertical. Those missions launched from pad 40 all the time. In fact, the first Dragon missions launched from 40 before 39A was even a SpaceX pad. So they'll have to do whatever minor modifications as far as connections and things for the new version of Dragon. But the strongback will have the exact same kind of configurability as 39A, where you can switch between a payload fairing configuration and a Dragon capsule configuration. So yeah, they'll be able to work that in relatively easily.
Gotcha. And a common question here, actually, that I want to clarify a little bit. Richard here asking, are the tower segments at Roberts Road possibly for Slick 40? Thomas, do we think there's any possibility there, or is that just we don't know what those are for right now?
I mean, never say never, right? I mean, SpaceX plans change on an hourly basis, especially down at Starbase, but that could certainly apply here at the Cape, too. The evidence that we have to suggest no is that NASA was previously asked, I think a lot of these briefings come out in advance of commercial crew mission. So I think back on the Crew 5 mission, which was the last one to have launched, NASA was asked about the status of adding crew launch capability to Pad 40. And they said that that work was ongoing, but that there was no fabrication underway yet. And at that point, there was already tower segments, as you could see in the flyover videos, like here, there was segments already were well underway, if not already done. And so that ruled out that the plan, at least at that point, was to use those segments for Pad 40. And then the another piece of evidence is that those segments have a lot of like Starship specific hardware and features on them. There are the rails and stuff that are used for the chopstick carriage and stuff like that. So those kind of things kind of rule out, I mean, in theory, you could retrofit a segment like if you really, really wanted to, but it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Like you said, it makes a lot more sense to design from scratch a very slim, bare bone structure that has, you know, 2 elevators for redundancy and a crew access arm. Boom, call it a day for Pad 40. And of course, we'll have to keep an eye out because it's certainly possible they will build those at Pad 40. That would not be that surprising, but we'll have to wait and see exactly where they end up. That's why we think the tower segments are probably not for them. Another piece of evidence, and I'm getting some numbers in the back channel to back this up as well. Apparently the documentation for the FAA regarding tower lights and things like that at Pad 40 for the new tower says the tower should be approximately 80 meters tall, and there are way more than 80 meters worth of tower segments at Roberts Road. Again, we do know that the segments at Roberts Road will at some point be able to support future Starship launch sites here at the Cape, but otherwise, lot more reasons to think that these segments are for Starship only, and they'll build something different for Pad 40 than the other way around.
Gotcha. Oops, sorry, Adrian. Looks like someone got a merch pie in the face. Simon here with the store has bought a NSF hat. So thank you very much, Simon. And their message is, sorry, Adrian. So at least you got a bit of an apology in there. But he's trying to, I see he's peeking up a little bit.
Yeah, I think you just got to like click it without even getting, I don't think Adrian deserves any warning. You just got to cover him up from occasion and make him deal with it.
All right. Okay, I guess we're going brutal here. and let's see, one or two more questions here, and then we are going to move on. Xwood here saying, can they build the tower to be high enough for Starship from the get-go? So I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding happening here. The tower at 40 is not being built for Starship. As of right now, there are no indications that Starship will ever launch from 40. Right. Now, of course, like we said, SpaceX plans changed on a whim, maybe somewhere super far down the road. But as of right now, there are no plans to launch Starship from 40. So yeah, there's no need to make the tower tall enough for Starship. Make it, like we said in the planning docs, 80 meters tall. That's just 10 meters taller than a Falcon 9. So that seems to fit very much in line with the size of a Falcon 9 crew tower.
And you know what? I'll add a quick point of discussion to this, because in the next coming years, we're going to have some launch pad shakeups here at Cape Canaveral for sure. You've got Delta IV Heavy, which has two flights left. Its last flight should be next year. And that pad, as far as we know, has no currently planned use for ULA beyond that, because ULA is kind of consolidating their operations into pad 41 with kind of a dual flow to support both Atlas and Vulcan for a time from pad 41. And also SpaceX is going to slowly but surely be transitioning from the Falcon fleet to Starship over the next decade or so. And it would be interesting to see what the future fate of pad 40 might be, because again, it's not a super big launch pad. We already know SpaceX is looking at kind of a clean slate pad design to go north of 39B. That's notionally called Launch Complex 49. So it seems like 40 might not have a future in the Starship program. It's simply, you would have to like bulldoze it and start over, at which point, why bother? Easier to just do a clean slate somewhere else at the Cape. There's plenty of room out here. And so it would be interesting to see if any pads change hands. I mean, we already saw Slick 6 over at Vandenberg is now ULA is wrapping up their work there with the last West Coast Delta IV Heavy. Could see that pad go to a new player like Blue Origin if they need a Vandenberg launch site for New Glenn, or SpaceX wants to snatch that up as a larger launch pad for Starship operations from Vandy or something like that. And I think we'll be asking similar questions to a couple of pads here at Cape Canaveral in the coming years.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, it's going to be pretty uncertain because it seems that medium launch is becoming very uncertain over the next decade. Like Falcon 9 is going to be phasing out. Vulcan already has their pad. Delta and Atlas are going to be retired. Firefly Beta comes to mind. That may be a potential player for Slick 37. But again, 37 would be kind of overbuilt for that. So it might just be a case of abandon it in place and see who comes along down the road. I mean, like you said, Starship already has two pads in the planning stages at Slick 49. Maybe they want to do Slick 37 as well. That would be generally the size of a Starship pad area, and it's a large area. So going to be interesting to watch the evolution of the Cape Canaveral pads over the next decade.
And as another just one thing, I would mention that Relativity also has the plans of incorporating their medium launcher at the same complex as their light launcher right now at Slick 16. And maybe Firefly could go a similar route there too, between Alpha and Beta here at Cape Canaveral. So there's other strategies there as well. But anyway, yeah. Adrian, please.
I mean, it also comes a lot down to the fact, like, how will Starship demand evolve and how much really do you need high cadence, fast following missions? I think the number one mission that probably requires a lot is always Artemis, because you need to refill a lot, you need a lot of tankers, you need the main launch itself. So there is some launches that probably would happen in a decent like time of succession. Like, there wouldn't be months between these. So the question is, how fast can a Starship pad turn around? I think there's also like still there's also some, especially in the small set area launches, that just prefer these very easy to use, very multi-purpose pads. So there could also be a ground if more of these, if the demand is there, demand of space is increasing. If you have like more multi-purpose pads and multi-user pads, where they just basically be like, hey, we have a good concrete pad here with a lot of commodities that you can plug in, please use it. I think there's always a balance to find, like, when do you want to warrant a single pad for a big rocket, and when do you just want to use like a multi-purpose pad.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of NASA's or Kennedy Space Center's big pushes now is to becoming multi-user spaceport. We know they've been attempting to do that when they had Omega come along, which unfortunately was canceled because of the NSSL contract. Electron Rocket Lab, actually, before they chose Wallops, they were seriously considering using Pad 48 at Cape Canaveral for small sat launches. Astra has done Pad 46. So there, like you said, there seems to be some demand for a clean pad design, and that's why Cape Canaveral or Kennedy Space Center did build Pad 48. Of course, there have been no users for that pad yet, but that doesn't mean there won't be any. But yet, like you said, it's going to be interesting to see the evolution of launch pad needs as well. Are companies going to want to have their own pad? Like, this is the SpaceX pad, this is the ULA pad, or, oh, pull your truck up here, put your rocket vertical, launch, and then clear the pad for the next user. It's going to be interesting to see how things evolve. One last question here, and then we are going to wrap it up in this segment from Dugong here, saying, when crew will fly from Slick 40, how will they escape from the tower? And I don't think we actually have any information on this. So do we know basket escape system, I would assume, would be the go-to option?
It should be. I would imagine they will take the same system that's in place at 39A, slide wire baskets to escape from the tower, should that be necessary, and adapt it to the tower at Pad 40.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, getting basket installed is probably trivial compared to all the other construction work they're doing. So like having some escape baskets probably is not that much of a deal.
We should ask SpaceX when they build it, if they'll host a media event for us to test out the slide wires, and just because it looks kind of fun if you do it in a non-emergency scenario, right?
I've been wanting to do that ever since Tori Bruno showed the picture of him riding
for Starliner. Yep.
With Slick 41, they don't have baskets. They have basically swings, like a little chair that you sit in and then go down the wire. And I'm like, that would be, I, even as someone who's terrified of heights, I think I might do that. I might not like it, but I would do it.
Can we make this a class trip of NSF? Like the whole class gets to go. Please.
We'll live stream it.
I was about to say members only video. Ian cries while going up the elevator because he's scared of heights.
Ian and Adrian being very, very happy to be here, and then suddenly realizing that this is 80 meters high.
Ian, who very much hates roller coasters, goes 80 meters in the air on an unsupported swing. Love that.
Wonderful.
That's going to bring us to the end of that segment. Real quick, I want to run through some super chats. We have some support from some awesome people coming through here. Ryan here with a interesting point of saying, did we see the new Starship specifications on SpaceX's website? They're quoting 250 tons of expendable launch mass and 150 tons of reusable, which in Ryan's words is crazy. And yeah, it really is crazy. I did see that this morning, actually. And important to note, bit of an asterisk, it says up to 250 tons expendable.
Yeah, that's the most important words in that sentence, by the way.
Up to 150 tons reusable. I would be absolutely shocked if Ship 24 and Booster 7 could get even close to that performance.
Nope, not a chance.
That is somewhere far down the road. Starship right now seems to be aiming for 100 tons to orbit reusable, which is still absolutely nothing.
Which is still absurd, just for the record.
Yeah, that is still, literally, that is useless. And I say that in a very good way. There is nothing that big, but there should be.
Yet.
Yes. Yes.
That, I think if they get to this kind of payload capability, we are once again getting into the Falcon Heavy situation, where you're like, yeah, well, I could launch a very dense object here, but you know, there's only a limited space which I can use here. So
you end up being volume limited before mass limited.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then they'll just make Starship super long.
Extend, have like a bulbous fairing. Like that side mount. It's that someone side mounted shuttle concept with like a bulbous fairing wider than the shuttle diameter. Ugh. But
I will build this in Kerbal later.
That is crazy numbers. Speaking of Kerbal, I need to rescue Jack's Kerbals who are stuck on Eve still. So that's me my task for tonight. I was up till 3 in the morning last night talking with Jack trying to rescue those Kerbals. Anyway, thank you for the super chat, Ryan. We appreciate that support as always. Westy the Third, a regular that I see in the super chat queue, saying just their Sunday contribution with 5 curly L's, saying thanks to NSF and all the people in chat who make their Sunday Eve more enjoyable. Well, thank you very much for tuning in, Westy. Thanks for the support as always, and we're glad that we could make your Sunday a bit more enjoyable. John Dopker saying, I will second that. I'm not too sure what John is referring to here, but I'm sure you made a great point there, John. And I appreciate the support as always. Again, another familiar face here. T. Bearham with 10 curly L's saying, waiting for Thomas to take his turn to get a merch pie.
But don't say that. If you don't say that, Michael won't move my camera to...
Oh, look at that.
All right, well, now someone has to buy merch, though, so I'll just hang out here. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that.
Well, let's see here. Moving on to our next topic. Why is this not working? So we're looking here at Vulcan on the stand, but very first, Thomas just got merch pied.
Hey, it's funny. They picked the right shirt, though, because that's what I'm wearing today. So nice choice. What are the odds?
John said they could not resist more merch. So they got the To the Moon and Mars unisex t-shirt. But unfortunately for Thomas, that is not all from John, because they also got what else comes up here? Oh, the launch and landing mug, the launch entry and landing mug. That's a very good choice. I love that design.
One of the new designs, highly recommend. Yeah,
absolutely. So I think it's all on our merch pies coming up here. So moving on to our next topic, Thomas is getting hit again. Hashtag when hat. Thank you very much, Dean, for that. And their message is saying, keep up the great job, guys. Sorry, Adrian, if this hits you. Well, Dean, don't worry. It did not hit Adrian. Adrian is fine right now. But thank you very much, Dean. And thank you very much, John, as well, for the merch pies. But anyway, moving on to what actually is on screen here. The first Flight Vulcan core has been mounted. It's on launch vehicle on stand is the actual name of the achievement. So the first stage for the first Vulcan flight has been put vertical on the stand at Slick 41, which is a very, very big milestone. Now, like we mentioned a little bit earlier, this is ULA's new rocket, which will be replacing both Atlas and Vulcan. So, Thomas, what's the significance of this? What is Vulcan going to be doing here? What are they testing right now?
Yeah, so this is actually, you may remember there was a previous vehicle called that we called a Vulcan Pathfinder that also arrived at Cape Canaveral, was placed on the stand, rolled out to Pad 41, etc. But as the name implies, at the time that it was only a Pathfinder, it had fake engines installed. The tanks were functional. They even did some kind of proof testing. I don't know if they were propellant or if it was just like nitrogen. But either way, they did some testing out of Pad 41 and also just rehearsing kind of the handling of how they use the cranes to lift it up and onto the launch platform and things like that. This is the real deal. This is the vehicle that will power Vulcan's first flight. This is the first stage that you see in this photo here. And there's two real BE-4 engines from Blue Origin on the first stage. And you can see it being lifted. And in the background, that's the Vertical Integration Facility, or the VIF. It's the same building that is used to stack Atlas Vs when they're getting ready for launch. And in there, you see the structure that says ULA that's kind of slanted off to the side. That's the umbilical mast on top of the launch platform. And this is the Vulcan launch platform. There's a bit of a slightly better view there as they start to raise it vertical. And so they lifted it up vertically. It kind of gets trucked in horizontally, raised vertical, and then placed on the launch platform. And they will do something similar, although Centaur is transported vertically. They'll do the same with Centaur likely early next week and raise that and install that onto the first stage. So you have both of the liquid fueled stages for the Vulcan first flight vehicle installed on the launch mount. Thank you for ordering your metal print there. They'll be installed on the launch mount in the VIF, and then they'll roll out the launch platform holding those two vehicles out to the pad to begin tanking tests, eventually culminating in a wet dress rehearsal. So that's the next couple steps coming up for Vulcan's first flight. Depending on how those tests go, they will be able to roll back. They're going to need to install two solid rocket motors, which are also here at Cape Canaveral already. They're the GEM 63 XL, so they're slightly lengthened compared to the GEM 63s that currently fly on Atlas V. And they'll also need to take the encapsulated payload, which will be the Astrobotic Peregrine Moonlander and a robotic Moonlander, as well as two test satellites for Amazon's Kuiper satellite internet constellation. And then also, I believe there's a Celestis Space Memorial payload being hosted on board as well. All of those things will be encapsulated in a nice big payload fairing. Unlike Atlas, Vulcan, all of the stages and fairings are the same diameter, so it's kind of one smooth structure, rather than Atlas, where you either have the 500 series fairing that bulges out, or the 400 meter fairing, or the 400 meter, the 400 series or 4 meter fairing, which you see Centaur kind of exposed and narrower, and then the fairing goes on top. Vulcan, it's all one diameter. And Centaur is the same diameter. It sits under the fairing. It's not within the fairing like it is on Atlas V sometimes. So they'll integrate that. They'll roll back out. There'll likely be some other integrated tests that happen both in the VIF and out of the pad there. And then they'll be ready to launch. I did skip the flight readiness firing, which I believe happens before they put on you know, the payload and the boosters and stuff like that. So wedge rehearsal, flight readiness firing, which is basically a static fire test, and then they'll integrate the last components and roll out for their launch.
Sounds good.
I love how Vulcan is doing just doing the sneak up right now on the first methane rocket to orbit thing.
You know? Because,
every time we talked about them before, it was like, yeah, it's like these three Yorkers, and also Vulcan is in the race, which probably is not really competing in this.
And then Terran seems delayed. Starship is as close as it's ever been, but also was slightly later than some of us were maybe hoping. Suki 2 had that failure. All of a sudden, Vulcan's like, very much in this race.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
We're a lot less clear in this race than we were a month ago, which is
weird. You would think it's the opposite. Yeah.
It's strange when you feel that Vulcan, while not a big chance, it may have a chance in this race. Again, not a big chance. I need to emphasize that. Mm-hmm. But there is definitely an alternate universe where Vulcan flies first. Let's see. So let's go through some questions here while we're discussing Vulcan. But real first, I'd like to facepie Thomas real quick. we got a new order here from Anonymous, but with their store matches saying pie to the face and goodies for them. So absolutely. They got the SLS unisex hoodie. We saw they got another shirt earlier. And they also got, let's see, what else did they get? They got a third item. Sorry about this, Thomas. the launch entry landing mug. That seems to be a popular one today. A very good choice. Definitely one that I would get myself personally. John White here with a 10 curly L super chat, 10 British pounds. I know some people in chat were saying the curly L's, 10 British pounds. Thank you, John White.
It's a joke.
Yep. No message, but we still really appreciate that. And a new store message too here. I guess it's face pieing that Falcon 9 up there. That's not the direction. Up there. There we go. From Ali here saying, when orbit, when hover and catch. There'll be a catch while hovering test for booster, right? Right? Probably not.
We'll
any thoughts
see.
Here?
I don't know. I mean, I know we're going to get into Starship, you know, with our kind of culmination segment of the show, but maybe it's hard to tell. I wouldn't give up hope yet.
What's the difference between a test and a real thing? Like just call the first ones a test. You're like, yeah. No, we're testing this.
Yeah, you might as well toss a ship on top and get something a little extra out of that test if you're going to launch a booster already. And plus, you can't really launch a booster by itself without a nose cone unless you do a very, very slow maneuver. But thanks for the order, Ali. We appreciate
my apologies
that.
If I like misinterpreted the question. I meant on that first orbital flight. We know they're not going to do it standalone with the booster, but on the first flight, whether they do a catch test kind of deal, we'll see.
Yep. I think that's still very up in the air, even with SpaceX. I am not sure if they even know what they're doing. But at the very least,
chat? The chat, did he even realize what he just said? No?
I realized.
What did I say?
Said up in the air, Ian. That was a great pun you did unintentionally. That was great.
Oh, we love that. Let's see. Some more here from Ali. Ali purchased 4 things from the shop. What else do we have here? We have Starship unisex hoodie. We had a Starship unisex shirt there before. Again, if you want to get any of these, a Wen Hop mug, a classic. Hop over to shop.nasaspaceflight.com. Excellent way to support the work that we do and get some cool goodies in return. A Texas Tank Watcher shirt. Kyle Aaron here has become a launch director member. Thank you very much, Kyle. We really appreciate that. And speaking of memberships, we actually have a question here from Space Nugget 82. I mentioned rescuing Jax Kerbals earlier, saying how can they rescue Jax Kerbals? Where do they find the file? Well, lucky for you, Space Nugget, I have the answer for you. Now, if you become a Capcom member or higher in our membership, which again is a great way to support the work that we do, you get access to the NASA Spaceflight Members Discord. Now, in that Discord, we have a gaming channel, and if you search back to August, it actually was late August.
It's pinned in the gaming channel. It's pinned.
Yes, it's pinned in the channel. You can download the save file and try to rescue Jax Kerbals off Eve. It took me 16 quick saves last night, I'm gonna be completely honest. But I got close. But yeah, if you want to give it a shot, Space Nugget, Capcom member or higher, get access to our members Discord gaming channel. It's pinned in there. So best of luck with that. Mary here saying, thank you for the endless educational and fun commentary in a store message. Let's see what Mary got. Mary got a When Sleep coffee mug. Love that. We're going to be asking When Sleep here very soon. All right. And let's see, where are we at right now? If my Google Chrome can work correctly. So we're going to move on to our next topic actually coming up is the SpaceX launch recap. Now, we actually discussed a bit of things that we saw at Pad 40. This is one of the launches that you can see, kind of see, the crew tower under construction down there. But we had the Group 5-2 launch from Cape Canaveral. It's the second batch of the Gen 2 constellation, although they're still launching on a version 1.5 satellites. But this was very important, Thomas, because this is a new record for Falcon 9, wasn't it? They're really pushing this rocket pretty far.
Yeah, and it's not even super clear how this record was achieved. Like, we don't know exactly what they changed. There's some reasonable speculation, but this set a new record for the heaviest payload ever launched by the Falcon family, coming in at just 17.4 metric tons, which was 56 Starlink version 1.5 satellites, basically. And so that is the most mass that a Falcon rocket has ever launched. And you may say, well, what about Falcon Heavy? Falcon Heavy is most often used to send slightly lighter payloads than this to a high energy orbit, going out to geostationary and things like that. So they need more energy to conduct that launch. But as far as pure payload mass, it's not the heaviest. The record now falls to this mission. And I think we'll expect future Starlink missions to probably tie this record too. Excuse me. But yeah, this was Group 5-2, which was the second mission of the Group 5 group of Starlink launches, which is actually part of the second generation constellation. And I say that knowing that the satellites themselves are likely not significantly different from the satellites from Gen 1, which have been all the other Starlink launches. And that's based on some documentation that SpaceX has filed saying we can start populating the second generation constellation with the previous satellites before the satellites that are optimized to be launched on Starship are ready to be launched, because Starship isn't launching to orbit yet. So either way, that's what this mission was in support of. It was also the ninth launch and landing for this booster, booster 1067. So SpaceX continuing to take advantage of the reusability of Falcon 9 to support the Starlink launch cadence as well. There was originally going to be another Starlink mission before the show, but it slipped 24 hours just this morning. The next one is from Vandenberg. It's Group 2-6. And that will also include a rideshare payload. So it's 49 Starlink satellites and a rideshare from D-Orbit, which is an ION CubeSat deployer vehicle that'll deploy on its own, and then it'll deploy any number of payloads. We'll expect more details after that flight. The next mission coming up tomorrow morning from Vandenberg, and then another mission from here at the Cape, Group 5-3 from 39A later this week as well. So a few Starlink missions in a row here for SpaceX over the next week or so.
Sounds good.
Just quickly checked. I think there's right now not even a mission listed for Falcon Heavy that would break this record again. So I think if nothing crazy heavy for Leo comes up, in a weird turn of events, Falcon 9 will keep that record. Maybe.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's then Starship, weird. I'm sure, will promptly break it at some point, because you're gonna.
I mean, with the first Starlink mission, they'll probably have like 50 tons of satellites on there, which is so weird to think about, you know, launching 50 tons to orbit on just a single mission. But that's not even half of Starship payload capability. We have a question here from Matthew Creighton saying, are the V1.5 sats mini, are they just V2 sats that are sized for Falcon 9? So are these the mini V2 sats that we've been hearing about, or are these, like you said, just possibly just normal satellites?
Yeah, very good question. So there are three different configurations of satellites that SpaceX filed with the FCC, which is the US government regulatory body in charge of regulating the frequencies that communication satellites use. There are three different configurations. These so far, based on the number of satellites on board and everything, appear to be the F9-1 configuration, which is basically launch the same satellites you're launching on all the other missions. That's what we're referring to version 1.5. They're improved from the first operational satellites that SpaceX ever launched, but they don't have version 2 hardware. There's a second configuration called F9-2, which utilize the same hardware that will be used on the Starship satellites, but they are slightly modified so that you can fit some of them in the Starlink and the Falcon 9 payload fairing. You would have way less satellites. You'd probably have, I don't think we know exactly, because I don't think we know exactly the size and mass of those types of satellites, but you wouldn't have 50 something satellites on Falcon 9. It'd be maybe half that or so. It'll be very obvious when they're launching different satellites, and SpaceX will hopefully say something to that end as well. So that's the second configuration. And then the third is the full up optimized design for a Starlink satellite, which will be much larger and can only fit within a Starship. And that'll be the third configuration that they can use to populate the second generation constellation. So no, these are not the mini V2s. That's the other Falcon 9 configuration that SpaceX has proposed, not launched yet. We'll see if they end up going that route. These are version 1.5 sets are the same ones being launched on basically all the Starlink missions these days.
Gotcha. Sounds good. Apologies, I'm butchering this name, from Jorg, saying that they think the record was reached by pushing limits, hence why Falcon 9, or hence why a Starlink launch, they jettisoned the fairings earlier, light stage two earlier, drain the tanks further, etc. And yeah, Jorg, you hit it right on the nail right on the head, because that's exactly what they do. If you watch a Starlink mission compared to, say, a Crew Dragon mission or a GTO mission, they basically pop the fairings right after the second stage engine ignites. They are really trying to just get every little ounce of performance out of Falcon 9 that they can. And I mean, we're seeing it here, 17.4 tons for a launch vehicle in general is pretty remarkable, let alone being able to recover the first stage and save a ton of money. So this is excellent, excellent progress from SpaceX. This is not only making Falcon 9 a more capable launch vehicle, but also informing them on how to make Starship a better launch vehicle. Falcon 9 is really a test bed for reusability for SpaceX. Every lesson they learn on Falcon 9 to make reusability easier, recoverability easier, is being applied to Starship. So this is great news for SpaceX R&D program. And it's great to see. You can literally see the changes and the optimizations between a normal mission and a Starlink mission. So thank you there, Jorg.
I will also add, you mentioned obviously reusability and recoverability being a huge part of enabling the Starlink missions. But what you're seeing on screen right now is an expendable portion of, well, all right, now they switched the camera views, classic. but on the right-hand side there is the Merlin vacuum engine, which is on the upper stage of Falcon, which is still to this day completely expendable. And you have to keep in mind that not only is SpaceX demonstrating reusability with the first stage, but it's not a fully reusable system until Starship is online. And those expendable upper stages are being produced at a rate where they can launch multiple times a week, which is not something to be ignored either. That system, you don't get any of that engine back. You don't get any of that tank structure or the avionics on board back. That's all going to be built fresh for every single mission right now. So that is simultaneously an impressive feat, because there are ways to responsibly deorbit your upper stage and avoid creating space junk or other pollution. But it's also a reminder that there's still room for improvement. Right now, partial reusability is what we consider the leading edge of launch technology. Most launch vehicles are still fully expendable. Only a couple are moving into the partial reuse phase. But in reality, the spaceflight industry needs to be going is full reusability, which is where Starship is going to come in, as well as a couple other proposed designs from other launch providers.
Yeah, and yeah, you're right. Go ahead, Adrian.
I think it's also like in terms of cadence, it's crazy that I think we are talking probably about the most, like the highest cadence of any second stage production ever. Like, I don't recall any other second stage that would need this many flights in a year. So it's a remarkable production line they're building, which involves not only producing them and shipping it to Cape, but also getting them to testing. And like, there's like a whole production line in this, which takes so much effort. And it's probably, if they really want to improve the cadence this year even more, this team has probably quite a year in front of them in terms of what they have to do.
Yeah. And like you said, Thomas, the second stage is expendable, but SpaceX is kind of going the, I guess you could say, like the Astra route or the Rocket Lab route, where they're like, okay, we know this is expendable. We know that it could be theoretically reusable, but we're going to try to get every bit of performance out of this and just streamline the production, make it as easy to produce, as fast to produce as possible. That seems to be the route that SpaceX has taken with the second stage. And you could actually see how often they're producing the second stage by watching MacGregor Live. We can see the second stage tests on there are happening incredibly often. And we actually published a video too fairly recently talking about what SpaceX would need to do to reach 100 launches this year. They would need 100 second stages at the minimum, which is a very, very big cadence to have. We know that in the past, during several points in the development and flight program of Falcon 9, they've looked into second stage recoverability. And while it on paper is absolutely possible to recover that second stage, it is not without its its difficulties. It would be extremely difficult to make it survive re-entry, to make it land. How do you land? Do you use the Merlin vacuum engine somehow? Do you have parachutes? Do you land it on a bouncy castle? And yeah, it's SpaceX has looked into several times doing recovery of the second stage, but it just doesn't really make sense when you have Starship on the horizon. Elon has said in the past, if there is a significant issue with Starship or a significant delay, they may look into it again. But at this point, they're really going full steam ahead with Starship. There is no sign that they are slowing down anytime soon with Starship. So Falcon 9 is going to fly in it this configuration, more or less, until it is retired. Falcon 9 has reached almost the end of life in terms of its development program. They're moving on to Starship. And it's exciting to see them move on to the future, but also it's kind of, you know, humbling or bittersweet to see the end of the Falcon 9 development program, something that's been around for so long. Moving on to some questions here, we have Cody here asking, regarding the used Falcon 9 boosters, what actually is reused? Do they swap out the engines or do all parts remain with the same booster? Adrian, what do they do in terms of recovery and refurbishment?
Yeah, they basically the answer is as much as possible. I would frame it like that. We know that they replaced parts in the past where they were like parts of engines were replaced. Or for example, I think we saw engine and landing leg replacement as well if the crash cores were triggered, or at least parts of these. Like they're trying basically to use as much as possible. But like for example, with an aircraft, if something is reaching their life limit or showing like significant damage, for example, an engine, you would replace that part and fly it again, and you would still preserve the rest of the booster. So that's what they do there. So don't expect like not every screw that was on the first flight will be on the 15th flight. There will be some changes there.
Yep, absolutely. And that's one thing that they're trying to kind of avoid with Starship. They want to make Starship and Super Heavy be rapidly reusable to the point where just a quick inspection, maybe change a tiny part here and there, but mostly have the same piece go and fly again, just like with an airliner. You don't see them swap out the jet engine on your airliner in between flights. But yeah, that's what they're trying to do with Falcon 9. Trevor, you're asking, does Falcon 9 use electric or hydraulic TVC? Thomas, what does Falcon 9 use? We know that this whole electric versus hydraulic thing has been in the news with regarding our next topic. But how about for Falcon 9?
So they're moving to electric with Raptor. I am stalling for time because I know there's someone else who is watching from our team that is watching the show right now that probably knows the answer for sure. I'm like pretty sure the answer is hydraulic, but I'm going to let someone in the back channel correct me unless it isn't. But I'm pretty okay. It's a job. Cool. Thanks. Cool. I was right. Total confidence. Never doubted it for a second. Yeah, it's hydraulic on Falcon.
Thanks, Alex.
And it's worth mentioning that that goes for both the engines and the grid fins. The grid fins on Falcon 9 are hydraulic controlled. And on Starship, they will both be the opposite. They'll both be controlled by electric motors.
Yep. Sounds good. And from Gwen Ever here, we're discussing the second stage recovery. Does the recent lofted tests show a way for second stage Falcon recovery? I mean, in theory, it does. Like, it's absolutely possible, but it's not as easy as just slapping an inflatable heat shield on the top of your second stage and calling it a day. There's a lot of engineering that goes into it. You need a properly sized heat shield. Lofted was just a subscale test demonstrator. But yes, absolutely, it is possible, but very, very, very unlikely we will ever see Falcon 9 second stage recovery. And I believe that we are all through on questions there. I want to run some super chats real quick, just to give some thanks to some people who've been supporting us. Leo with a store message here saying it's all chill until Blue Origin gets to orbit first. Well, that would be pretty great. New Glenn takes the title as the methane rocket to reach orbit first. Thank you very much, Leo. We appreciate that.
That would probably require, though, some other very major developments on all the other four contenders. Like, no hit on Blue Origin. There is some time before they fly, and that it would require multiple things going wrong for every other of the providers.
Is it ironic that someone named Leo sent that message?
Ooh. Okay.
Moving on.
Moving right along. Brandon Meyer here with the $20 super chat saying, love the Sunday live streams. Just checked out the shop. One request, bigger coffee mug options. 11 ounce is just too small. I see we have a coffee drinker here.
Yeah. We'll pass that along.
We'll pass that along to one of our store
team members. Oh, yeah. Wait, Adrian's here. Right here. What am I saying?
There he is. Thank you, Brandon. We appreciate your support as always. Stephen Lees has become a Capcom member. I see someone wants to try to rescue Jack's stranded Kerbals on Eve. So check the gaming channel in the members Discord, Stephen, and see what you can do. Anonymous here with a store message saying, are we nervous for the 33 engine static fire? I think we'll discuss this a little bit more later, but we'll get into that in just a few moments here, Anonymous. Thank you very much for the support as always. Kerbal Gaming, thank you for bringing a red team member. Thank you very much for the support there. We hope you enjoy all the perks that come along with your membership. Ben Thomas with a $2 super chat saying, could SpaceX make a reusable second stage for Falcon? Well, lucky for you, Ben, we've already gone over that question. In theory, yes. In practice, probably not. So thank you for the support there. And Thomas Pazantek here saying, when are they thinking of doing the static fire of the 33 Raptor engines?
Yeah, well, I think we just got to get to that, don't we?
I was about to say, yeah. I think on that note, we kind of need to move on to our next topic, the big one, you might say, for Starship. Now, we had a very interesting week here. And Thomas, before I go, thank you very much for support with the $10 super chat. So we did have a very big week here for Starship. Now, first off, we did have the first full stack wet dress rehearsal test, which is where that SpaceX stacked ship 24 on top of booster 7, fully loaded it with RP1 and kerosene. That is absolutely not it, with liquid methane and liquid oxygen, Starship's two propellants. So they fully loaded it. They did a countdown simulation. We saw them do a water daily or fire suppression system test, just overall a full launch day rehearsal, and it seemed to go really, really well. So Thomas and Adrian, whoever you wants to take it, any thoughts on this wet dress rehearsal? Major milestone in the Starship program.
Adrian, go for it.
I think before this test, everybody of us expected maybe a few retries, not gonna lie. I was at least in this camp, and I think that's a reasonable expectation. A wet dress rehearsal is a complicated thing. I know there was some simplification talk about it, like, well, they're just loading two tanks. Four tanks. They are loading. This is complicated. This is a very intense flow, and them nailing this in the first try, and it looked very, very smooth. I feel like that's it's a very big success for the Starship team and SpaceX. This for sure helps them in meeting the very ambitious timelines they sometimes set them, because yeah, getting this to work, amazing. And it was cool to see. It was probably the biggest test in Starbase since the Hops. I say probably, but I think it very much is the biggest test since the Hops. So this big success, and next up is one more test with the 33 engine static fire, which will make things even more funky.
Absolutely. And I just got to interrupt real quick because someone made a question in chat that is absolutely killing me. 33 Raptors is asking how many Raptor engines will be fired in the 33 engine static fire.
Oh, well.
Well, Thomas, how ideally, many engines are they going to fire in the 33 engine static fire?
Ideally 33. But that is, I guess, emphasis on the ideally part.
Oh, I love that. ideally 33 engines. Let's see. And yeah, we got some great camera shots here during the wet dress rehearsal. You can see we got a bit of a time lapse here. Well, time lapse Jack's gonna kill me. We have a sped up video here showing a propellant loading in the booster. Lots of venting around the base of the site here. It was like a fog machine going off. But yeah, slowly but surely, it took them about, I think it was like, Adrian, like an hour and 15 minutes to fully load the propellants, you said.
Let me just quickly stall for time while I look at my Twitter where I have this noted. I just want to, just to break time, is there a difference between speed up and time lapse? I didn't know that.
Yes.
Okay.
Because a time lapse is a sequence of photos taken every whatever interval that then gets rolled into a video. But if you take the video at real time and then you speed it up, that is not a time lapse. They're two different things.
I don't see the difference between those, but I will not argue with the man who is paid to do camera stuff.
Yes.
Meaning
thank,
Jack.
Thank you. And yes, was 1 hour and 15 minutes from the first moment where we saw a frost ring appearing to us declaring that this is probably full at this point. Yep. What 1 hour and 15 minutes of fueling, which I would say, based on what we see on Falcon 9, that's very reasonable and probably in the right ballpark of what we would expect for a countdown for Super Heavy and Starship.
And what we're looking at right now on the screen, we have the large methane vent that we saw from the Super Heavy booster. And someone here asking in chat, McCall here asking, any thoughts on this massive methane vent? Why is it just spewing pure methane? Do we think this is normal, or was this a bit of a maybe like a glitch in the countdown, do we think? Any thoughts on that? Because this was a lot of pure liquid methane being shot out of the vehicle at one point.
Here's what I'll offer as a couple different options in the absence of an official update of any kind. I mean, we know the wedge rehearsal was completed nominally and that they're moving on to the next milestone. So if it was, if this was off nominal, or if it was just not, even not necessarily if it was off nominal, if it was outside of what the normal propellant loading flow would be, it clearly didn't affect the rest of the operations. But I think we won't know what the normal flow is until it happens several times. Mm-hmm. The objectives of a wet dress rehearsal are slightly different from those for the actual launch, and things like that. So we will see things change over and over again, I'm sure. And even as they themselves, even if this was part of the normal procedure, they might change the procedure. And so the important thing is that the test was completed successfully. We would definitely be interested to know if every single thing in the test went perfectly, or if they had to work around some things, and maybe that vent was part of a workaround of a different issue and before they finished the test successfully or something like that. Or maybe that was, you know, an off nominal event that they, you know, worked around itself. So there's a couple different explanations. SpaceX didn't provide any official information on that front, so it's hard to know for sure. I think we'll get a much better idea, however, what the normal flow is, and especially for, you know, right now in Falcon 9 flows, we know every step of the Falcon 9 flows. So off the top of our heads at this point, we know every vent, we know, you know, every sort of visual indicator and things like that. And we'll get to that same point with Starship after enough flights. So it's just going to be a matter of time.
And just to add something to this, there could also be just like with Falcon 9 that this was just like a bit of methane or non-methane at all. Like, we don't know exactly what this vent was composed of. We only know it was a big cloud emitting from the booster.
Well, and we know where it was. We know it was coming from the methane tank. I don't think there's any plausible explanation for anything other than that was a methane vent.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, keep in mind that cold methane gases will also condense some of the water vapor around there. So the plume you see isn't pure methane because it's also condensing the air and the water vapor around it too. But the thing that's coming from the tank, I think, can only be methane.
Okay, fair. And my second is, I don't think this wasn't like a 100% super worrying, because they conducted more tests after that. We saw them conducting a Fire X test after this. So I think if you were worried, oh my God, we just might have broken something, I do not think they were like, okay, this is broken, yeah, let's fire X next. I think
while we're at it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's full anyway, just fire this. No, I think that at least confirms, like, even if it's slightly off normal, I think it's not a major big deal. That's just my feeling on this.
Gotcha. And while we're talking about we're looking at Ship 24 on the screen, kind of the star of the show over the past few weeks. Are we expecting any static fire tests for Ship 25 prior to the orbital launch attempt? So you can see in the background on the screen here, you got Ship 25 kind of sitting as an audience member, or maybe a little jealous of Ship 24. But it's sitting on orbital pad B right now, which seems to indicate it's being prepped or has been prepped for static fire. Have we had any word on any upcoming closures for Ship 25 static fires?
Even if we had a word that a closure would be used for static fires, we wouldn't know probably which vehicle. Like, we would know, okay, there's a road closure, and we would know there's an overpressure notice. So the moment we would know the vehicle would probably be the moment where we see one of the vehicles being prepared for static fire. So it's hard to say, I would say. Like, we don't have that view until we see a tank farm spooling up.
Sounds about right. And it seems that, you know, this coming week is kind of the earliest possibility for a 33 engine static fire. I would assume that that's kind of their main priority right now. Ship 25 is the backup for the orbital flight test, or on the other hand, it is also in line for the second orbital flight test. So there's a bit of a dual purpose there, but either way, it's not as high priority, at least I would imagine, it's not as high priority as 24/7 is. We're getting some great shots here. The build site, we got some future ships and some past ships and past vehicles. You can see on the right there inside the Mega Bay, Booster 8 is being scrapped. The methane tank has been cut off of it and is being scrapped. Booster 8, of course, was coming after Booster 7, but they decided to skip it in favor of Booster 9, which will be coming for the second orbital flight test. We also have multiple nose cones in production, including one fully flapped out, probably for Ship 28, I believe that is. Very cool to see the next vehicles coming up in line here. So even if there are still very good odds that, and again, this is not necessarily a bad thing, but there are still very good odds that the first orbital flight test will not be a perfect success. But in SpaceX's book, that really doesn't matter because they have multiple vehicles in line here. As you can see, we have the nose cones, we have extra ships, extra boosters coming up. So great future cadence coming up there from Starship. Badger57 here asking, during the wet dress rehearsal, after the Fire X started, was there a spin prime test? So, Adrian, did they perform a spin prime test during the wet dress rehearsal?
I saw some. There was a, like, we saw some gas being emitted from the engine section, but if you compare this to any previous spin prime test, there's a big difference between there's some gas puffs and a spin prime. Like, you can see a spin prime really emitting a lot of very directed gas into below the vehicle. It's very visible. So I do not think this was in any shape or form a spin prime test. This was probably just related to some outflows. It's not comparable to anything we have seen on previous spin prime tests.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it wasn't even like a puff. It was just like a cloud of emitting gases. And there could also be the situation where they test like engine chill, they mm-hmm. test like some things that would create vapor inside the engines. So there's probably something going on in these engines, but definitely not a spin prime for this test.
Gotcha. Now, Thomas, I'm going to hit you with the big Starship question of the week right here.
Oh, no.
Do we know why Ship 24 has gone to the Rocket Garden? Seems to be a possible bad omen, but then again, they seem to be doing some work on there. Do we know why it's gone to the Rocket Garden?
Well, I don't think we know exactly, but I think it's nothing to be worried about. We saw over the last couple of days, they've been removing the lift points on the top of the nose cone of Ship 24. On this view, you can see them on, I think that was Ship 25, but it's the points that are used for one of the normal cranes to lift the vehicle and move it around. But it's not used when they use the chopstick arms on the orbital launch mount or on the launch tower to move the vehicle. You don't need those lift points, and they also take the place where there are supposed to be heat shield tiles for reentry. And so they were removing those because it sounds like Ship 24 will no longer need to be moved by any miscellaneous cranes. It'll just be lifted by the chopsticks up for the orbital launch. I think it's just a matter of logistics as far as where they had room to complete that work. They're working on other vehicles in the production site, in the Mega Bay and the High Bay and stuff like that. I know we were all confused for a little bit because we expected it to just head to a high bay. But I don't think it's anything to worry about. I think it's just a matter of where they had room to do it. It's not exactly like it doesn't need to be a clean room environment of any kind to just remove points and mount a couple extra heat shield tiles. And I don't know, we don't have exact details on what other final prep work might be needed, but it's probably not that much. Maybe some FTS work and stuff like that. And maybe that's it. Maybe it's a matter of, hey, if we're going to be doing pyrotechnic devices like the flight termination system, maybe that's best to be worked on outside of the rest of the production facility. That's me literally purely speculating on a thought I had 10 seconds ago. But I know it was different from what we were expecting, but it's really nothing to worry about. Fully expecting Ship 24 when it's ready and after the booster completes its static fire to roll right back out to the launch site and be prepared for stacking for the orbital launch attempt.
Gotcha. Let's see. We have a question here from Nadine here asking, what is the expected force of all 33 Raptor engines? So I think the basic answer there is almost 7.6 meganewtons, which is an insane amount of thrust. I think that's double SLS's thrust, approximately.
Not quite. I think it's like I think SLS in the 40s, right? I don't have like exactly every number.
I don't remember exactly.
SLS being like a low. So, this is actually going to have the number.
Oh boy, you're making us Google stuff.
I am. Hold on, I'll get back to you.
But either way, this is the 33 engine static fire. Once it happens, will set the world record for the most powerful active rocket stage, which is very exciting.
Not only the most powerful active rocket stage, the most powerful rocket stage.
Oh, yes. Like, yeah, absolutely.
No contender.
So the liftoff thrust of SLS Block 1, the current version of SLS flying with four RS-25D engines and the two current versions of the solid rocket boosters, is 39 meganewtons. And then the liftoff thrust of Super Heavy is, I guess, is it 70? No, that's not right.
Should be 75.9.
75.9, yeah.
So
meganewtons. So a little under, not quite double, but.
But I think going almost double the most powerful rocket in the world is kind of a pretty big milestone.
Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely. It's going to be very exciting to see the 33 engine static fire. And speaking of the 33 engine static fire, Adrian, do we have any indications as to when that could be? Is there any thoughts there?
Well, the net date is definitely always the current next road closure. I think that's the way we have to operate right now. With this, we are getting more into the classic static fire watching, which is wait for the overpressure notice, wait for the usual signs like an extensive air closure coming up. That's what we expect. A NOTAM notice to Mariners. As soon as we get these, it's getting more concrete. But right now, I would basically say net Tuesday because I'm lacking more knowledge. There's still work going on the vehicle. We saw them working on a hydraulic pressure unit, which is removed, actually, I think, as we can see here. So there's still work on the booster going on. So we will see and have to see how that progresses. So, but yeah, just... Oh, yeah, also, Alex mentioned Best Channel, they are replaced Raptors as well. So that could also be the case, and just to blind that out here, and don't expect maybe a static fire of 33 engines right away without any more testing, especially with them now replacing two Raptors. We could run into a situation where they might maybe want to make sure these are properly integrated with like a spin prime before they move on. We just don't know. We don't have like a detailed view on this. So... yeah, stay tuned for the week. I think watching this week very closely is a very good guess what to do to stay informed.
Gotcha. Sounds good. Going to be very exciting either way. And I think the really big notice that it's happening is going to be an evacuation notice for Mary and for Boca Chica Village. Because
I don't think there will be an evacuation notice, right?
Yeah, not for a static fire, because it can be a partial propellant load. Overpressure notice for sure, but it's not going to be the same, you know, potential energy as the wet dress rehearsal where you had fully loaded propellant. You only need to load enough for weight purposes and to fire the engines for a couple seconds. So not expecting an evacuation necessarily.
I'm honestly surprised by that because I know 33 engines is going to be pretty loud, but yeah, I guess in the worst case scenario, there's not going to be too much damage. And you can see here on the screen, ship 24 was destacked from booster 7. Like we said, it was rolled back to the rocket garden. Again, not necessarily a bad sign there. Some great close-up shots here of the engine bay on ship 24. I always love seeing those Raptors in there. And I noticed those Raptor vacs in there that we can see on the screen right now are a little different in terms of their mounting and structure, their supporting structure around them. It seems they've had their... ground static fire rings, their support rings removed, because we know that the Raptor vacuums, because they're not optimized for sea level use, it might be a little unstable compared to being fired up in the vacuum, because like their name suggests, Raptor vacuums are optimized to fire in the vacuum, so they need to add a bit of reinforcement on the nozzle that is then removed ahead of launch. So great sign there that ship 24 is getting closer and closer to launch preparations. A fly perspective here asking, are the slight collapse or the dents on the booster 7 methane tank meaningful in any way? Is it any sign of a danger or damage there, Adrian?
I wouldn't say as long as they bump out, no. I'm not an aircraft specialist, but somebody in the NSF Discord already pointed out even aircrafts dent sometimes. Like there's even in the tanks of aircrafts, there's like there can be denting and it's not a big of a deal. So this is steel. It can move a bit. There's wiggle room. And also we saw this many times before where they had vehicles dance when it's unpressurized. And then they put some fuel into the vehicles and everything dents out. So yeah, I'm not worried about that unless there's like a crack there and we suddenly see the tank opening, but nothing else matters.
The dents are pretty, in fact, this is, if you go back far enough, I mean, the early Atlas missiles and rockets, which were also stainless steel construction and required pressurization to maintain their full strength, there's a limited amount of pressure difference and denting you can experience that won't actually affect the strength of the material or anything. So a little bit, as long as you can pressurize the vehicle and confirm that it's at full strength again, is fine. It's not ideal, especially when you deal with the ship that has those heat shield tiles attached to it. Obviously, you don't want to be moving the surface of your vehicle in that particular instance. But there's an acceptable amount, and I wouldn't jump to any worrisome conclusions about the booster the other day. They seemed to be repressurized it and had no issues.
Gotcha. And another big question, given the 33 engine static fire, how do we think the concrete on the base of the pad is going to fare given all that power being shoved directly onto it? Any predictions here on amounts of damage, maybe no damage? What are we?
No damage. Good joke.
No damage. Yeah, no way.
I'm trying to be
here's the thing. The most engines they fired at once was 14 engines, and we saw them basically have to resurface the entire thing. So I don't know. I mean, a big part of me says they're going to do the 33 engine static fire, and then they're going to have a lengthy stand down to repair the pad before they can try to launch again, even if the vehicle itself is perfectly okay. And we're just waiting for that deluge system that's coming from Cape Canaveral so they can not have to do this every time they fire the engines. Comes back to the why didn't they just install a flame diverter conversation as well. I mean, there's a lot of questions, but the biggest thing is that they are already in work to kind of future-proof the site and make it a little more streamlined between engine firing events with a deluge system that appears to be on the way. But safe to say that unless they install that system before the static fire somehow, which is unlikely, it's not expected to even get there in time, pretty likely that they will have some work to do between the static fire and the launch attempt.
Yeah, I think as long as the vehicle is unharmed after this test, I would call this about my expectations. Like, I think there will be extensive damage to the ground. There will be extensive, probably like repainting of every of the legs and everything with the protective coating. I would be very surprised if there would not be a big visible damage by this.
I would agree, honestly. And I think SpaceX is kind of waiting to see what happens as well, because I mean, they've never done anything like this. Obviously, they've never done a 33-engine static fire. This is all just a test campaign. How's it going to fare? And we've even seen on our MacGregor flyover videos, they've installed a sort of test platform in front of one of the Raptor test cells, which is basically a mount to put materials on, put steel on, put new types of concrete on, see how they react to actual Raptor exhaust and actual Raptor plumes. So I think this is just another part of the test campaign. However it goes, it's going to go. And there's a question here in chat, actually, too, that I literally did just lose, but saying, here we go. Will the new water deluge system be added to the OLM before the 33 engine static fire?
Well, as I just hinted, unless they have that static fire, I mean, they got to move the static fire back from this week till next, probably, to have any sort of time to install an entire deluge system. Because I think the ship that Gavin was tracking is on a barge being sent from Kennedy Space Center isn't even supposed to get there till Tuesday, if I remember correctly. Maybe even later than that. I don't remember off the top of my head. It's not supposed to get there like today or tomorrow. And then you need a ton of time to actually install the thing. So right now it's very unlikely. Now, could they install it between the static fire and the launch? That is a more plausible question. But it could also be equally possible for them to simply not install it until after the launch, and they'll have it installed for the next launch campaign, basically.
Gotcha. Sounds good. We had a few super chats coming in through while we were asking or answering some Starship questions here. So KPMP or KMPM, thanks for becoming a PadRat member. We really appreciate your support there. And Raul here has become a Capcom member. So Raul's going to get access to our members Discord. So enjoy all the chaos, the good chaos that happens in the members Discord, Raul. And again, thank you to both of you for all the support through the memberships. Ninja Decimator here with a $5 super chat here saying their 37th birthday is on Tuesday, hoping SpaceX gives them a 33 engine static fire that day for a present. Thanks for all we do and keep it up. Well, happy early birthday, Ninja Decimator. And yeah, same here. I really hope that you get a nice birthday present there.
But what does he have against ninjas? Like, why would you designate him? Yeah, cool.
With a username like that, I wouldn't ask questions. Well, I don't want it to become a pineapple decimator. But thank you very much there. And Stefan Battist here with a €6 super chat saying, would the future Starship be in danger if static fire results in a RUD and damaged or destroyed tower? I mean, it certainly wouldn't be good for Starship. I don't think the future of Starship in general would be in danger, but I think it would definitely be a significant drawback and a significant slowdown in the schedule. But I wouldn't necessarily call it a danger to Starship.
Right. Like not like an existential threat to the program.
Exactly. Yeah, it'll be a drawback. Very disappointing for sure. But the good thing is the static fire, like Thomas said, is going to have a very minimal propellant load. Literally all the propellant they need for a 5-second static fire and nothing more. So even if worse comes to worse and we have an SN4 like event on there, given that the orbital pad is much more reinforced than the suborbital pads were, there probably won't be extensive damage. Of course, it won't come out unscathed, but it will not be a major drawback like, you know, destroyed tower or anything, at least hopefully. But thank you, Stefan, for the support. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, like just like to add to that, I mean, let's be real, a destroyed pad or a destroyed tower, we would talk about no chance of Starship launching in 2023, because the next thing that probably would come up then is the Cape. And I think we all would agree that there's no chance in hell that Starship Cape would be ready to launch from the Cape this year. Like, this would be a year-long delay.
Yes, absolutely. Let's see here. Jay is asking, in terms of a bit future Starship flights, how will payloads be integrated without a giant clean room building? And when will we see a full-size cargo door on the ship? Any guesses? So, Jay, actually, you kind of answered your first question in the question, because they are building a... To quote you, they are building a giant clean room building. There are planning docs. There's no really clear plans on what they're doing, but there are planning docs stating that SpaceX wants to build a full-sized clean room to integrate Starship payloads in. Now, I don't think they were really clear on exactly what that means, whether that is the whole Starship rolls in, they toss the payload in and then roll it back out, or if you just put the nose cone in there and integrate the payload. Either way, that's a pretty big building, but it seems that they're going to do it at least somewhat integrating into a Starship. And as for your second question, Thomas, any thoughts? You're Thomas. Any thoughts on when we're going to see a big chomper cargo bay door?
Yeah, or you know, whatever the cargo bay door ends up looking like. It's been a while since we've even heard about it. So here's the deal. So once orbital capability is demonstrated, the next thing you're going to see is a Starlink deployment, which, as we've already seen, is they're calling it the PES dispenser, where you just have a thin slot because the Starlink satellite's nice and thinly packed. And that's a certainly less complicated mechanism than a big payload door for more traditional satellites. I think we'll see those missions pretty soon, and we will also see on-orbit refilling demonstrations, which might literally be bare bones, nose cones, like don't even put a payload on board. The purpose of the mission is to be on orbit and demonstrate moving commodities between different vehicles. Those are the missions we're going to see first, once prototype vehicles that can simply make orbit with no other goals in mind are launching. Those are the first actual missions we'll see. Eventually, we'll have to see a prototype of the human landing system, which will be a much more sophisticated vehicle, more sophisticated than any of the others for sure, because that's got to be crew rated in at least a certain sense, not for launch, but for crew operations once on orbit. And they're gonna have to get that off the ground as soon as possible, because that's a near-term mission that they want to meet for the Artemis program. So all of those things considered, and given the success of Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy, is there really a huge rush for there to be the normal payload bay version? I mean, maybe that's not a huge adaptation from the Starlink version, and so maybe R&D on that particular variant of Starship isn't that much of a demand, and maybe they already have the design pretty much ready to go, they just haven't built it yet because they don't need it yet. It's hard to tell without any sort of up-to-date news, but I think Once on-orbit capability is achieved and we know they're going to move into Starlink and on-orbit refueling as probably the two near-term goals of utilizing Starship launch capability, I think it'll be interesting to see how the manifest starts to shake out for Starship launches and when we might get a glimpse of that kind of payload bay. That's a small enough change between the other Starship variants and vehicles that it may be possible that the first flight we see with a full-blown payload bay carries an actual paying customer on board. Especially if it's can be drawn with some heritage with either it wouldn't be with Falcon per se, because that's a deployable payload fairing, but something like the Starship var or the Starlink variant of Starship. Too many words to start with star. But yeah, it might be a while. I don't think it's the near term priority, but hopefully sooner rather than later, maybe the next couple of years.
Gotcha. And well, yeah, we do know that they have contracts with I believe it's Telesat, and I know SES is looking into launching geostationary commsats on Starship. So they're going to need some way to get them out of Starship.
Right.
We know that the most recent Pathfinder they've done with a nose cone, basically where they take a nose cone and cut a hole out of it just to test how they're going to make it work. I think they use like Ship 23s, but anyway, it seemed that they were only doing the nose cone barrel, only having opening cargo bay doors similar to the shuttle on the nose cone
Yeah.
barrel.
So not the coned part that actually tapers in, the kind of cylindrical part that's above the fuel tanks but below the rest of the nose cone.
So it seems that they are missing out on about, I guess, like a third of the volume of the payload bay. But I mean, the complexity of having to integrate a payload bay door, cut it out into the nose cone, have it be curved somehow, deploy while still staying in place during launch. It seems there's, I would assume there's going to be multiple variations of the payload bay door as both Starship evolves and as payload needs evolve. Because I'm sure there will be payloads that will come along that are going to need the whole cargo bay size, such as, say,
Right.
a space telescope. But yeah, there's
Also,
going to
I
be.
mean, I would be interested to know, maybe you know, Ian or Adrian, that just the barrel nose cone door or nose cone door, payload door that Ian mentioned, like how does that compare with the size of most commercial satellites these days? Because if a normal satellite actually fits through that size door, maybe the concept is not to utilize the entire nose cone, but maybe it's a ride share idea where like, yeah, you can deploy one satellite through that door, and then a second satellite that's farther up the nose cone can be, transported down by some sort of mechanism and deployed. And it's kind of setting up for a sort of ride share launch opportunity for geosats.
Well, the first thing
So
that comes to
Alec,
mind. Oh, go ahead, Adrian.
just like in length, that is already the size of the non-tapered section of the Falcon 9 fairing. Just
There you
as
go.
Alex suggested. So it would be able to fit basically every normal commercial read right now. The
That's
question is
currently
more,
being used, yeah.
yeah, like do you push the envelope or you just want to like make the envelope happy that is paying your bills? That is a weird sentence to say.
Yeah, I mean, they're only going to need to utilize the nose cone space if they either like A, want to fill the thing to the brim with Starlink satellites. Again, we don't even know the mass of the Starlink V2 satellites, so we don't know if they're already at their limit by putting them in the nose cone barrel
Right.
alone. But for bigger payloads, like say what I mentioned before, the space telescopes, if you wanted to put, say, like the Luvoir space telescope, which has been proposed to fly on Starship, you would need to cut out the nose cone proper to have a much larger payload bay section. But again, it's likely only going to happen because like we mentioned before, the complexity of having a curved payload bay like that, the complexity is only going to, it's only going to come along when needed and if needed. So will be interesting to watch that come along. I think we're going to have just a few more questions here and then we're going to wind it down for today. Richard here asking, going back to Ship 24, when and where will the test payload be installed in Ship 24? Adrian, do you want to take this one?
Never. The answer is they shut down the payload door. The answer is most likely never. And unless there's a, I'm stealing from Thomas' book here. Never say never. But like unless there's also like a huge sudden plot twist where they suddenly install a payload here, the answer is probably that the first orbital launch of Starship and Super Heavy will have no test payload on board. It will
I
be an
mean,
empty flight.
yeah, the test payload is the ship, and if you want to frame it that way, even, right? Like the point is to demonstrate that you can get to orbit with these two vehicles, and then potentially, depending on how the flight profile works out, some sort of experimental reentry too. But a payload beyond that is not in the plans, as far as we can tell.
And not
I
only
think
that,
they.
the payload bays for Ship 25 and Ship 26 have been sealed up as well. So it's going to be a little while. If ship 25 and 26 do fly, it's going to be a little while before we see any payloads fly on Starship that are deployed.
I think I would, based on SpaceX track record, I would be very surprised if there's not a meme somewhere on this vehicle. I'm just not sure how they will do it yet, but I'm betting there will be something funny, something we not expect yet or we don't know yet somewhere on this ship.
Maybe like a little Hot Wheels car inside the payload bay. Instead of a full on
of like the Tesla Roadster.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Put like a little, just a little Hot Wheels in there inside.
I like the idea of like a Cybertruck or a Tesla semi. You got to like increase the mass if you're going to do it on Starship, but that's just me.
Launch a Falcon 1.
Falcon 1 kick stage on Starship when you need something at Pluto tomorrow.
Yeah. Oh my God. Put a Tesla semi in there. They have some Pathfinders they don't need anymore. Oh, let's see. And just one last question here, looking into the far future here from Anthropologist. What should we look forward to after the orbital flight? Pretty unclear.
The next one. But is there...
yeah, pretty much. Probably some repairs to the orbital pad after the flight for sure. Definitely some inspection, maybe some upgrades here and there if they're like, all right, let's take a little downtime here, just fix some things, improve some things. But if things go well, the next flight shouldn't be an incredibly long amount of time later. We say that now, and it could be 2 years until the next flight. We really don't know. But yeah, I guess the next major thing to look forward to is the next orbital flight. And with that, we are at 4:31 Eastern time. So it's bringing us to the end of our show today. First off, we hope that you all enjoyed our newscast today. Thank you, everyone, for sending in your questions, sending in super chats. Thank you especially to all of our channel members. It's a great way to support the work that we do. It's been absolutely, we can't even describe how helpful this is. You bring live streams like McGregor Live, Space Coast Live, and Starbase Live possible. So thank you to all our launch directors and our flight engineers for their incredibly, or their especially generous support to the work that we do. Again, we can't do it without them. Thank you also to the people who bought things on shop.nasaspaceflight.com and slapped Adrian and then later Thomas in the face with some merch pies. Again, shop.nasaspaceflight.com. We have a new Falcon 9 landing configuration collection. Very cool. We got some shirts, mugs, sweatshirts. Seem to be pretty popular during the show today. So why not join the, why not hop on the bandwagon? We also have some Starship merch, some SLS merch, some calendars. We're getting to the end of January, but still not too late to get a calendar. I don't have a calendar yet, so maybe I should get on that too. But once again, thank you to everyone who supported us. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you as well to who's over here. This is Adrian. Thank you, Adrian, for being a great co-host today and sharing your knowledge with us.
Thanks for having me. I always love this because we can talk a bit more about like rocket topics we don't get to talk about on the broadcasts.
Absolutely. It's a very in-depth, but also very broad discussion. It's always fun to be a part of. And
wait.
Thank you, Thomas. Double thanks to Thomas, I guess.
All right. Yeah, thanks for having
Adrian,
both of us,
your,
I guess.
Your hair color changed Adrian's real back. Quick. Some rapid hair dye.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure, Ian.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was Ian Atkinson, writer, editor, and live stream host of NASA Spaceflight. Thank you once again, everyone, for tuning in. We hope you have a great rest of your weekend and a great week coming up. And we'll see you next week.
Yikes. You bet.
Concur.
We don't need any more of these.